thank you for joining us.
In today's top story, Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian teen, identified as 15-year-old Milad Muntha Al-Rai, was shot dead in Al-Arub refugee camp north of Al-Khalil. Local Palestinian media said he was shot in the back in a raid by Israeli forces. Several other Palestinians were also injured. Israel has stepped up its crackdown on Palestinians following the formation of a far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At least 230 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets for the 36th consecutive week to protest against the controversial judicial curbs by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet.
This is the 36th week in a row that we're demonstrating against Netanyahu's attempt to make a coup in Israel and make it a dictatorship. This demonstration is 3 days before the deliberations in the Supreme Court to disable the law that they passed right now.
Mass protests against a judicial overhaul described by protesters as a judicial coup have been ongoing since it was proposed back in January. Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the plan in August. It set off an unprecedented domestic crisis resulting in public unrest, labor strikes and mutiny by some members of the military. Critics say the move removes vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. They say they will continue with the protests until they are able to repeal the legislation. The Supreme Court will hear an appeal against the case on September 12. Israeli soldiers have reportedly rioted during a training session for the regime's infantry forces, a sign of rising discontent in the Israeli military. A leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from the Golani Brigade vandalizing property and letting out angry shouts. According to reports, the riots happened on September 4, 2023.
A recent video circulating on social media shows Israeli soldiers of the Army's Golani Brigade rioting during a training session in protest against the far-right Israeli cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent controversial policies. The leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from Israel's Golani Brigade shouting and vandalizing property. According to the reports, several of the protest participants had been disciplined by superiors, resulting in the arrest of several soldiers, including sergeants. The regime's Golani Brigade is mostly made up of elite soldiers specialized in ground warfare. They have carried out armed attacks against Palestinians and have participated in almost all the wars waged by the regime. Ever since the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the proposal for the judicial overhaul, which limits the authority of the national judiciary, the public has held mass demonstrations across Israel. Tens of thousands of military personnel from different sectors of the Israeli army have protested against the decision, including 10,000 reservists from intelligence units and Air Force pilots. They have threatened to no longer show up for duty in protest of Netanyahu's judicial reform efforts. Last month, Israel's Air Force chief suspended a number of senior military reserve forces in the wake of ongoing demonstrations against Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan. The development came a day after the Israeli Navy suspended two high-ranking reservists after they announced plans to end volunteer reserve duties, in addition to refusing to serve in what they called a dictatorship. Also, cases of suicide within the Israeli occupation forces have grabbed headlines recently, with observers blaming a mental health epidemic among soldiers.
The soaring level of discontent with the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu's policies has placed Israel in a dangerous situation. Israeli officials have warned that the regime will be facing an existential threat if the current trend continues. However, is it going to end, or is it just the beginning of Israel's collapse from within?
In July, Israel's chief of staff, General Herzi Halevi, warned that the army's unity has dangerously deteriorated due to the thousands of reservists who have threatened to hold service in protest against the judicial overhaul Israel faces. He also warned that Israel would be in existential peril. Some other Israeli military officials have warned that the reservists' protests are impacting military readiness amid heightened tension between Israel and the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas in recent months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters have rejected the reservists' protests as a dangerous and unprecedented form of political blackmail by the military, with some equating the protests to attempts at a military coup. Despite the threat of reservists refusing service, Netanyahu's far-right cabinet pushed ahead with the judicial overhaul legislation. The Knesset passed the legislation in a vote in July, despite months of large protests. The legislation struck down the ability of Israel's Supreme Court to veto legislation passed by the Knesset based on the criteria of reasonableness, despite calls from the protest movement to protect what they describe as Israeli democracy. The protesters have not called for the Netanyahu's cabinet to cease.
Search and rescue operations are underway in Morocco to find the survivors of a deadly earthquake that has claimed over 2,000 lives so far. Morocco's Interior Ministry says efforts are in full swing as the army, security services and civil protection are mobilized to provide immediate relief. Local officials say most deaths are in the mountain areas that are hard to reach. The 7.2 magnitude quake struck in Morocco's High Atlas Mountains on Friday. Buildings have collapsed, historic sites damaged, and countless residents rushed from their homes in the country's deadliest tremor since at least 2004. A group of anti-Iran elements have attacked the country's embassy in the French capital, Paris. A spokesperson for the Iranian embassy said the anti-Iran elements burned tires in front of the embassy building and inflicted minor damages to the structure. The spokesperson added that the fire was put out shortly after the presence of police and fire brigades. The official says the situation is now under control and that France's foreign ministry has been notified of the incident. The official noted that an investigation is underway into the attack to find those behind the incident. Iran's president warns about the military presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus region amid rising tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Ebrahim Raisi also says any geopolitical change in the Caucasus is Tehran's red line. We have discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic is seriously opposed to the presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus. In a phone call with the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, Raisi said holding joint drills with foreign forces in the region only further complicates the situation. The remarks came after Armenia announced plans to hold joint war games with the U.S. The Iranian president said any geopolitical change in the Caucasus and the region's borders is Tehran's red line. The Armenian premier, for his part, hailed Iran's stance towards developments in the region. He said that Iran has always played a constructive role in promoting peace and stability in the Caucasus. Tensions have recently risen between Baku and Yerevan, with reports suggesting that Azerbaijan has concentrated its troops around the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Rashid Bagherian is a political analyst who joins us from Karaj in Iran, and Isha Krishnaswamy is a journalist and podcaster who joins us from Madison, Connecticut. Welcome to you both. Farshid, let me first start with you. You know, every time we approach this subject, there's many different dynamics that are involved. Briefly, if you can, tell us what exactly is the points of friction that could lead to a bigger crisis if it's not dealt with in the right way, at least in the Iranian perspective.
I'm afraid of repeating my previous words that this part of the world, I mean, the Caucasus, is destined to be conflictful or agitated, full of agitation. And there is turmoil is some part of this destiny of this part of the world. And any new engagement is inevitable. Remember the Nancy Pelosi's traveled over and they promised the Armenian, especially the Armenian administration, that we'll be back over here again. Remember the election race between Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, and Mr. Trump lost the electoral number, huge number of electoral in the California because of the Armenian, he ignored the Armenian lobby in that part of the United States. And this time, the Republicans are trying to reevaluate the power of the Armenian, I mean, lobby. For this reason, they are, how can I explain? They are trying to be here, not part of the geopolitical changes. They are trying to be here to changing the administration of the not only the Caucasus, Central Asia, and paving a new road. And this is the presence of the United States in the landlocked country like Armenia is airborne for airborne drill is only a part of a big plan to be penetrate to the Central Asia and to be an ambush for the Russian administration and the collective and security collective pact. Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us, Esha, what is going on with the thinking behind Armenia? It seems like, obviously, they are somewhat discontent with Russia in terms of the protection that they feel Russia is not. Is it protection or attention? Maybe it's both, that Russia is not giving to them. But to go and have joint war games with the U.S.?
Well, let's remember what happened is that in 2018, the U.S. staged a successful color revolution in Armenia. Before, there was a more neutral prime minister, Serge Sargsyan, and now we have Pashinyan, who is, Pashinyan, who is very much a pro-U.S. figure. And of course, the main thing is that they do not want something like the CTSO uniting as it did in late 2021 when there was a color revolution attempt in Kazakhstan. So the U.S. presence is merely to do what they always do, to kind of divide the region, stop any kind of inter-regional cooperation, anything between Iran and Armenia or Iran and Azerbaijan. And certainly the Belt and Road presence plays a big role. So I think it would be a mistake to think that of the Prime Minister of Armenia as a completely autonomous figure. He is a lot more similar to the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, because of how he came to power, which was through a U.S.-backed color revolution.
Okay, very well. We'll leave it there. Thank you for that, Esha Krishnaswamy, journalist and podcaster there from Madison, Connecticut. Thank you, Farshid Bagherian, political analyst from Karachi here in the Islamic Republic. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Syria has denounced the illegal entry of a U.S. delegation into its territory as a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty. Damascus says the trip of the delegation led by U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Goldrich amounts to a breach of international law and Security Council resolutions. The Syrian government has decried the delegation's meetings with U.S.-backed militant groups in northern Syria. Damascus says the claim that the visit is aimed at addressing the problems of the residents of Deir al-Zor is a sheer lie and reflects Washington's hypocritical approach. Damascus says the U.S. plunders the wealth of the Syrian people and imposes unjust, illegitimate, and inhumane coercive measures on them. Now to Iraq, where Arbaeen mourning ceremonies have now ended and pilgrims are on their way back home. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi, who covered this year's Arbaeen for us, has traveled to Qadimiyah near the capital Baghdad, where the holy shrines of two Shia imams are located. She says Arbaeen offers pilgrims time or offers them time to reflect on the doctrine of Mahdaviyat, which basically refers to the reappearance of Imam Mahdi at the end of times to rid the world of evil and injustice.
Pilgrims visiting the holy shrines of Qadimiyah on their way back home. The complex located in Qadimiyah near the capital Baghdad is the resting place of the 7th and the 9th Shia imams, as well as the tomb of a prominent Shia theologian and jurist, Sheikh al-Mufid, who made key contributions to Shia jurisprudence and helped shape what today is referred to as the doctrine of Mahdaviyat, the belief in the reappearance of the 12th Shia imam, Imam Mahdi, as the savior of mankind at the end of times.
Imam Mahdi had to go into a state of occultation because of the threats to his life after his father died, during a period of about 7 years, which is called the minor occultation. Four successive deputies represented him, and he is believed to have communicated regularly with his followers through these deputies. We are now at the resting place of the third deputy. The second deputy's resting place is just a few streets away.
According to Muslim beliefs, with the death of the fourth deputy, the major occultation began, and it will continue until God grants Imam Mahdi permission to reappear and bring peace and justice to all. During this period, Muslims are expected to pray for his reappearance and take action to facilitate that. This provides the basis for a very different philosophy and perspective than what the international public opinion is pushed to accept. Being totally different from materialistic and atheist schools of thought, Mahdaviyat can positively impact how people interact with each other in different levels, from ordinary people to high-ranking government officials.
Imam Mahdi is believed to return at the end of time to rid the world of all evil and to spread justice. The doctrine based on this belief is called the Mahdaviyat doctrine, which in today's world can create a major shift in political and economic equations. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Kademiya.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Up to 750,000 children, postpartum adults, and others eligible for WIC in the U.S. could soon be turned away from the aid program. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote, Republican threats to shut down the federal government if spending isn't drastically cut have put funding for a critical nutrition aid program at risk as hunger grows across the United States of America, with the recent lapse of pandemic-era assistance leaving many low-income families struggling to put food on the table. The Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, commonly known as WIC, is one of many federal programs that could face severe impacts if Congress fails to fund the government by September 30. As the Washington Post's Tony Rahm reported recently, while USDA technically can operate WIC if federal funding lapses, states could only continue paying benefits for as long as they had leftover money. A shutdown at the end of 2018 into the following January, for example, brought some states, within a month of having to cut benefits, institute wait lists, or take other drastic actions, Rahm noted, citing a Washington state nutrition official. Nearly a decade later, state leaders and nutrition experts feared the fight in the nation capital once again could leave millions of women and children in a financial bind. WIC, long a target of Republican lawmakers, gives states grants to provide nutrition aid and other assistance to pregnant and postpartum adults and children up to the age of five. House Republican appropriators have proposed sharp cuts to WIC for the coming fiscal year, even as policy experts say a significant funding increase is needed as participation in the program grows. In a recent report, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, warned that up to 750,000 eligible toddlers, preschoolers, postpartum adults, and others eligible for WIC could be turned away from the program if the House GOP's proposed funding levels become law. Another 4.6 million toddlers and preschoolers and pregnant postpartum and breastfeeding participants would have their benefits cut significantly, the group estimated, adding, in total, the House bill would cut food assistance for or take it away altogether from roughly 5.3 million young children and pregnant postpartum and breastfeeding adults. CBPP argued that the program will need roughly $7.3 billion in total funding for fiscal year 2024 to provide full benefits to WIC recipients. Republicans, who already secured more strict work requirements for SNAP recipients in a debt ceiling deal with the White House, want to approve just $5.5 billion for WIC. The far-right House Freedom Caucus, which has dozens of members, has threatened to oppose any short-term funding agreement that does not impose steep cuts to federal spending and put an end to the unprecedented weaponization of the Justice Department. An apparent reference to the prosecution of former President Donald Trump, the House, led by Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy, is set to return from August recess next week. As CNN reported recently, GOP hardliners in the House are eager to play a game of chicken over the end of the month deadline to fund federal agencies seeking to force the White House and Senate to make a choice: accept a slew of conservative priorities or risk a debilitating government shutdown. Republican appropriators have called for major cuts to a range of federal programs related to education, environmental protection, and more. Representative Rosa DeLauro, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee, wrote on social media recently that House Democrats are ready to move on funding for disaster relief and other crises. She added, House Republicans are listening to their most extreme members on steps that could slow the flow of relief and put us to the brink of a government shutdown. According to Guardian, can you name the top 10 causes of death in the United States of America? Without too much trouble, most Americans could likely come up with some of them: cancer, heart disease, stroke, accidents. But it would come as a surprise to many to know that poverty is right up there with these other dreaded scourges. much higher, in fact, than many ills that have inspired investigative committees, major policy investments, and sustained attention from the public and private sectors in American life. A recent study by one of the colleagues in Guardian shows that culminative poverty over the years is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States of America. Current poverty, just being poor right now, is seventh on that list, and it alone causes 10 times as many deaths as homicide, close to 5 times as many deaths as gun violence, and 2.5 times as many deaths as drug overdoses. Culminative poverty that lingers year after year is associated with approximately 60% more deaths than current poverty, putting only heart disease, cancer, and smoking-related deaths ahead in the number of Americans it kills. But if this is true, why do we hear so much about crime rates, opioids, and gun violence in America, but so little from elected leaders about the crisis of poverty? Why is there no Surgeon General's warning on low-wage jobs? The relationship of poverty to disease and death is a well-established fact detailed in reports by the World Health Organization, the World Bank, or the government. But the people have become numb to the unnecessary deaths that are normalized by the ways they often think and talk about the economy in public life. Guardian added, sadly, the United States is the leader in poverty among rich countries of the world. As of 2019, the U.S. had the worst poverty rates overall, 17.8%, and in children specifically, 20.9% among the other 25 wealthy countries that are part of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. In addition, poverty affects all Americans. 75% of all Americans between 20 and 75 years of age will be among the current poor or near poverty for at least 1 year of their lives. Contrary to popular belief, poverty is hardly just the province of the inner city. Only 10% of poor Americans live in high poverty census tracts. Most are spread out across the country. They are neighbors. And although the rates of poverty are highest among communities of color, by sheer volume, most people living in poverty are white. Finally, poverty is a drag on the U.S. economy. Child poverty alone in the United States of America presents an $8 billion to $1.1 trillion price tag based on reductions in adult productivity, criminal justice costs, and the cost of health care for children from poor families.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, here is a maxim from the Holy Prophet's fourth infallible successor, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, who during his captivity in the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus, boldly said, "Beware of matters against which God has warned you. Abstain from matters from which God has ordered you to abstain. Do not copy the inclination of those who regarded this world as a permanent abode."
Thank you. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, asking for forgiveness in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's such an honor to be here in your presence, dear friends, dear listeners. We are talking about how asking for forgiveness is really a fundamental part of a Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, this Islamic lifestyle, as we have said in previous programs, stems from the Holy Quran and the seerah and the sunnah, the behaviors and the teachings and the manners and the morals and the ethics of the Messenger of Allah and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, peace and blessings upon them all. Now, one of the things that we find that we have been taught when it comes to living a Islamic lifestyle is this idea of asking for forgiveness. You know, unfortunately, we sometimes commit sins. And unfortunately, we might have committed sins in the past. Now, sins are, in reality, disobedience of the Almighty Allah. It is breaking the commandments of the Almighty Allah. Now, this disobedience and this committing of sins, what it does is that it creates rust upon the heart, or it tarnishes the heart, it stains the heart, right? And so this stain and this tarnishing of the heart is almost like, you know, if you veil the heart, you cover it up with darkness. And what that does is that makes it very difficult for one to live a pure Islamic lifestyle, right? So one of the things that you have to really do in order to live that Islamic lifestyle is to ask for forgiveness. And this is something that, as we said, has been taught to us by the infallibles and the immaculates, whether it is the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, or the divinely appointed Imams, alayhim wasalam. We have to ask for forgiveness, and not just so that we can purify our hearts, but when we realize that we disobeyed the commandments of the Almighty Allah, then we really should feel a sense of shame and embarrassment that we did so. And so this asking for forgiveness is in reality trying to rebuild that connection with the Almighty Allah that we willingly or unwillingly broke ourselves. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how seeking forgiveness is part of a Islamic lifestyle. And as we said in the previous program, sometimes, unfortunately, we end up committing sins, or unfortunately, we have committed sins in the past. These sins that have been committed or are committed, they create a sort of baggage, this sort of weight that holds us down and does not allow us to fly towards the heavens. Now, the only way for us to be able to remove these weights or these chains, these shackles, if you will, is to ask for forgiveness. Now, once we ask for forgiveness, of course, this removes those shackles. But there's different ways of asking for forgiveness. There are different steps that are involved, which unfortunately we can't go into too much detail because of lack of time. But first and foremost, we need to have this sincerity in asking for forgiveness. We also need to feel regret. We need to feel shame that we disobeyed the Almighty Allah. And that in itself is something which is so ugly, disobeying the Almighty Allah because of some sort of base, low, or carnal, you know, inclinations or desires that we had. And then after that is to really be sincere in our forgiveness. That means try our best to not commit that same sin again. And if for some reason, God forbid, we end up committing that sin again, never give up in trying your hardest to stop committing that sin. You should believe, and you must believe, that the Almighty Allah is helping you and will help you. The main thing is for us to be able to continue to avoid committing a certain sin and realizing that committing that sin is harmful. Never feel okay with committing a sin. And over a certain amount of time and practice, and by the grace and blessings of Allah, that forgiveness will become a part of our Islamic lifestyle until eventually we will be able to minimize the committing of sins and really attain that pure and beautiful Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
On June 20th, 2023, Albanian police raided a camp belonging to the anti-Iran terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, the MKO, on charges of terror and cyber attacks against foreign institutions. Shortly after, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani tweeted, "Due to their terrorist nature, the MKO will always be a danger to the security of its host country," adding, "This is why the Iraqi government expelled them and other governments refused to accept them. We hope the Albanian government makes up for its mistake in hosting this terrorist cult." The fact is, as a bloodthirsty group, the MKO is no stranger to terrorist attacks on foreign soil, and its dark track record in Iraq is just a case in point. Before moving to Albania in the mid-2010s, the MKO had lived in Camp Ashraf in northeast Baghdad, Iraq, for more than two decades under the aegis of the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. And before that, the organization had carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian officials and civilians, drawing some 17,000 people to the jaws of death. In fact, the MKO's long list of crimes against their own compatriots made the group a trustworthy partner to Saddam Hussein, who was in an all-out war with Iran. In June 1987, that's less than a year after the MKO established its base in Ashraf, its leader, Masoud Rajavi, announced the establishment of its army at the service of his Iraqi godfather. As native Farsi speakers, members of the MKO army could easily infiltrate Iran's military forces, gathering intelligence on the front line for the Iraqi regime. The army also carried out tens of military operations against Iran. But the MKO mission didn't come to an end after Iran accepted UN Security Council Resolution 598, which called for an immediate ceasefire. In fact, Saddam Hussein evinced even more interest in the group that had shown no mercy to its compatriots. It could serve as his private army in troubled times. The Iraqi dictator then equipped the MKO with an array of modern tanks, personnel carriers, and even helicopters, and trained its members under the supervision of Iraqi seasoned commanders. Up until the year 1988, Iranian civilians were almost the MKO's sole victims. But gradually, Iraqi citizens, including Iraqi Shias and Kurds, also fell victim to the organization's heinous crimes. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded neighboring Kuwait, seeking to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his eight-year-old war on Iran. But the Iraqi dictator had made some miscalculations. All his erstwhile Western and Arab supporters stood up against him. So he experienced a second humiliating defeat within a period of a decade, this time in a war called the First Persian Gulf War. The perception that Saddam Hussein had become vulnerable to regime change triggered widespread uprisings against him that lasted from March to April 1991. Initial protests turned into widespread uprisings in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. Just a few days after the start of the uprising in the south, which is also referred to as the Shabaniya Intifada, due to its concurrence with the month of Shaban, another wave of insurgency broke out in the Kurdish-populated areas in the north. Against such a backdrop, the army and intelligence services proved ineffectual in the face of nationwide uprisings, and the dictator was in danger of collapse. But one thing changed the course of history to the detriment of the Iraqi people: the MKO army. The fall of Saddam Hussein meant the fall of Rajabi and his cult. So he deployed his task forces to Basra to infiltrate the protesters in order to identify the leaders of the uprisings. Because there were Iranian nationals, no one suspected them to be the regime's agents. The MKO members accomplished their mission, and within a short period of time, the leaders of the uprisings were all arrested and sentenced to death. Many more went missing for years. Their tragic fate came to light after the fall of Saddam Hussein and the discovery of mass graves. The MKO also helped the Ba'ath regime suppress Iraqi Kurds. Following Saddam Hussein's defeat in the First Persian Gulf War, Kurdish fighters took over Kurdish-populated cities in the north. In addition, they brought under control some areas in western Iraq. While the regime's ragtag army was busy with the uprisings in the south, the time was ripe for the Kurdish fighters in the north to go to Baghdad and topple Saddam Hussein. But here again, the MKO came to save the Iraqi dictator through blocking the Kurds' way to the capital until the arrival of the Iraqi reinforcements. According to the New York Times, Maryam, Masoud Rajabi's wife, told her fighters, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards," meaning the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. With the MKO's vital support, Saddam Hussein remained in power for more than 12 years, and with the group's help, thousands of Iraqi Kurds were killed in a bloodbath that later came to be known as the Anfal genocide.
There are over 1,500 people buried here. They are mostly women and children. There are just five men. All others are women and children. They are Kurds from Kurdistan. We believe they are victims of Anfal campaigns in 1988, that Saddam Hussein's regime committed genocide crime against the people of Kurdistan.
The mass killing of the Kurds in the north resulted in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Kurdish families. Many Kurdish women and children lost their lives to the cold and hunger, while many went missing. After the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, Iraqi prisons were the only hope for the families to find their missing loved ones. But as was with the case of Iraqi Shias, mass graves found in prison yards dashed their hopes forever. In 2003, the Iraqi people saw the long-awaited day when the senile dictator was finally arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to death. But as the main accomplice to Saddam Hussein's inhumane crimes, the MKO has so far avoided trial. Ironically, in recent years, the group has made democracy and human rights its new mantra, a desperate attempt to hide its ugly past. The raid by Albanian police came a few days after France banned an upcoming MKO rally in Paris. Has the West come to its senses? And will it stop harboring the terrorist group on its soil? History shows that the MKO is not like a gentle, caring guest, but a cannibal who can feast voraciously upon the flesh of the host with no remorse.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Antarctica is often described as one of the most pristine places in the world, but it has a dirty secret. Reports say Antarctic research stations have polluted a pristine wilderness. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote, historical bad practices have left a legacy of pollution, but efforts are on the way to chart a better future. Antarctica is often described as one of the most pristine places in the world, but it has a dirty secret. Parts of the sea floor near Australia's Casey Research Station are as polluted as the harbour in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, according to a study published in PLOS One in August. The contamination is likely to be widespread across Antarctica's older research stations, says a study co-author Jonathan Stark, a marine ecologist at the Australian Antarctic Division in Hobart. He says, these contaminants accumulate over long time frames and don't just go away. Stark and his colleagues found high concentrations of hydrocarbons, compounds found in fuels, and heavy metals such as lead, copper, and zinc. Many of the samples were also loaded with polychlorinated biphenyls, highly carcinogenic chemical compounds that were common before their international ban in 2001. When the researchers compared some of the samples with data from the World Harbour Project, an international collaboration that tracks large urban waterways, they found that lead, copper, and zinc levels in some cases were similar to those seen in parts of Sydney Harbour and Rio de Janeiro over the past two decades. The problem of pollution is not unique to Casey Station, says Sisha Puoro, manager of policy, environment and safety at Antarctica New Zealand in Christchurch. She says, all national programs are dealing with this issue. At New Zealand's Scott Base, which is being redeveloped, contamination left from past fuel spills and poor waste management has been detected in soil and marine sediments. More of this historical pollution will emerge as the climate warms, says Puoro, adding, things that were once frozen in the soil are now becoming more mobile. Most of Antarctica's contamination is due to historically poor waste management. In the old days, waste was often just dumped a small distance from research stations, says Trent Palmer, a marine scientist at Texas A&M University Corpus Christi. Research stations started to get serious about cleaning up their act in 1991. In that year, an international agreement known as the Protocol on Environmental Protection to the Antarctic Treaty, or the Madrid Protocol, was adopted. This designated Antarctica as a natural reserve devoted to peace and science, and directed nations to monitor environmental impacts related to their activities. But much of the damage had already been done. Roughly two-thirds of Antarctic research stations were built before 1991. And although historical pollution is a problem, future pollution remains a concern as the icy continent becomes more crowded. There are already more than 100 research stations or national facilities, and most of the buildings are located in ice-free areas, where they jostle with wildlife for a foothold on the most viable land. Ice-free areas make up less than 1% of Antarctica, but they support the highest diversity of plants and animals, including penguin and seal colonies. A 2019 study found that more than half of all ice-free areas on the coastline have ground disturbance that's visible from space. Sean Brooks, a conservation scientist at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Hobart, who co-authored the study, said the stations have quite a large footprint for the number of people that are there. Each nation is responsible for its own environmental monitoring around research stations, and practices vary, says Brooks. He and his colleagues have proposed a solution in a preprint posted on the Social Science Research Network last month. They outline a 9-step process to help station managers set objectives for reducing the impact of their facilities on nearby ecosystems. Researchers are working on ways to reverse the damage of past practices. Lucas Martinez Alvarez, who specializes in bioremediation at the Argentine Antarctic Institute in Buenos Aires, and his colleagues are using bacteria to remove hydrocarbons from soil around Argentina's Carlini base on King George Island. In 2020, Martinez Alvarez and his team reported that they were able to remove more than 75% of hydrocarbons from fuel-contaminated soil. The approach could reduce the need to ship tons of contaminated soil out of Antarctica, says Martinez Alvarez. Stark says that the Australian Antarctic Division has already begun upgrading wastewater treatment facilities at its Casey and Davis stations. The next step for Stark and his colleagues is to assess whether historical pollution continues to affect Antarctic ecosystems today. Stark's earlier studies have shown that polluted areas in Antarctica are less biodiverse than control locations, with some resilient species becoming more dominant. Stark says it will be interesting to see if these effects have persisted or gotten worse, or if communities had adapted in any way.
Trout.
Part 2.
A relatively hot day in the fall of 2017.
That day, in the small town of Zegora in southern Morocco,